There's a whole generation of people who have no living knowledge of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, USSR, just the Soviet Union in most references. The physically largest country in the world came apart, broken back into Russia and Ukraine and Belarus and a dozen other countries with distinct cultures and languages. They are fascinating places, fascinating enough to make our next guest want to visit. So she did. Audrey Murray took her comedy and writing skills to the former USSR for a book called Open Mic Night in Moscow. Audrey is a stand-up comedian from Boston who plied her trade in China. She's the co-founder of Kung Fu Comedy, comedy with a K, and was named the funniest person in Shanghai by a magazine there. She now lives in Brooklyn. Audrey, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
So let's get to a couple of motivations here. First, what attracted you to the high-pay, low-competition field of stand-up comedy?
You know, I think it was actually something I never thought that I would do. I was living in China, and I was looking for a way to sort of meet people when I first moved there, and I started doing improv comedy, which is a little bit different because there's a group of people on stage. It's not all about you and your jokes. And while I was doing improv, a friend said to me, "Hey, I'm thinking of starting up a stand-up night. I'd love to have you join." I said, "That sounds terrifying. No, thank you." And he said, "Well, if you don't do it, there won't be any women on the show." And I said, "Sign me up." And I think I was just hooked after the first show that I did it.
So you can be dared easily. Is this what you're telling us?
Yeah, actually, that's a pretty reoccurring theme throughout my life. What first brought me abroad was actually a friend daring me to move to China. And yeah, I guess I'm really sharing some information that can be used against me. But yeah, I guess I would say that's true.
All right. So you hadn't done, I mean, any stand-up comedy before you were in Shanghai?
No. Yeah. I mean, I think I had grown up watching a little bit of stand-up. I guess I had gone to a few shows in college. I watched a few, but not many big specials. And I think, like a lot of people, I just thought it would be terrifying, and that's sort of what made me never consider it seriously, even though I always enjoyed writing humorous pieces and being funny with my friends. It just seemed like the stakes were too high to get on stage.
So let's talk about the other motivation involved in leading to your book here, which is the fascination with not actually Russia, but the whole Soviet Union, dead and obviously not really buried.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's something about the Soviet Union that always sort of lingered, I guess, in the back of my mind. My parents had grown up during the Cold War, and my dad in particular told us a lot of stories about how he felt growing up, that the Soviet Union would eventually one day take over the United States. And so he had studied Russian in college to sort of prepare for that inevitable outcome so that he might have a job. So I think there was that sort of like larger than life, but sort of murky image in my head. And then I had a few Russian boyfriends in my 20s that I think really took what was a spark of interest and ignited it into something much bigger.
Well, and it got very big. I mean, did you actually have an itinerary before going to the former Soviet Union, or did you just kind of pick a place and start letting things go on from there?
Yeah, I think I looked at the easiest city to fly into, and from where I was, that was Almaty in Kazakhstan. And I was like, great, I'll start there. And I don't even think I had a return ticket at the beginning of my journey. I really played it by ear. And that ended up working out because, especially in Central Asia, you could find a lot of information online, but so much of the really interesting things I was able to organize, like I took a lot of horse treks and I stayed in yurts in the countryside. And that wasn't really something that you could organize online and in advance. You had to show up and sort of find a guide who could take you.
So in chapter one, you mentioned flying into Almaty, the capital of Kazakhstan, or was anyway. You opened for who?
I opened for a meditative drum circle, and I was not myself performing anything meditative. I was doing a stand-up set. I flew in to Almaty, and I was staying at a hostel, and the hostel had organized this meditative drum circle night. And when they found out I did comedy, they said, oh, you know, you should perform a set to open. And I was like, you know, first of all, a meditative drum circle is not exactly a crowd that's going to be hungry for stand-up
comedy. Not prime for stand-up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Not really ready to laugh. But I was also concerned that the audience wouldn't really speak English. And that turned out to be true. But it was such a fun experience because about half of the people there did understand me. And I was able to get through a 10-minute set. Everyone was very nice. They clapped a lot. And actually, the bongo player from the meditative drum circle jumped on at one point and sort of provided a rhythmic backdrop for my jokes.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he improvised a rim shot for you.
Oh, no, actually, I taught him to do that before the show. So I had him do that, at the end of my punchlines. If I felt like most of the room hadn't understood the joke, I would point to him, he'd do ba-dum-ching, and then everyone would laugh.
One of many stories well told in Audrey Murray's book, Open Mic Night in Moscow, which is subtitled, and other stories from my search for black markets, Soviet architecture, and emotionally unavailable Russian men. A fascination with the Soviet Union turns into a fascination in person with the countries that once made up the Soviet Union. That's what the book is about. Audrey Murray returns to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30 and tells us more about her experiences, and you can join us as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Audrey Murray, who is a stand-up comedian from Boston who actually worked doing stand-up comedy in China for a while. She's the co-founder of Kung Fu Comedy and named the funniest person in Shanghai by a magazine there. She lives in Brooklyn and is giving interviews about the book she wrote about her fascination with the former Soviet Union and her exploration of many other republics of the former USSR. The book is called Open Mic Night in Moscow. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Audrey, you do give plenty of history and geography lessons along the way, and thankfully you explain Stan, all those Kazakhstans and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. What does all the Stan mean?
Yeah, so actually it's just Persian for land of, or I guess maybe something that today would translate more like country or nation. And so I talk about in the book how that word, I think, can be so scary to Americans. The meaning is, of course, so innocuous. And that was really how I felt while I was traveling there. Central Asia wasn't a place I knew much about. It was definitely, when you hear a name like, yeah, Afghanistan or even Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, I think you think, ooh, I don't know if I'd want to go there alone, but I found just the most warm and welcoming people there, and I actually felt really safe for most of my time in those countries.
So you did go alone, you're saying, then? You didn't have any companion with you?
No, sometimes I met up with other travelers on the road. So in my book, I write about a 10-day road trip I took along the border with Afghanistan with a French man that I met through the tour guide who organized our group. And he was a really interesting person to travel with because he'd been in the region before and was just also one of those people who's able to be so open and generous with everyone he meets while traveling. But for the most part, yeah, I was alone.
So let's talk about some of these places. You mentioned you didn't know some of the Central Asian republics that well, and it's funny when you mention the names of the capital cities because I'm sure they're probably lost on a lot of our listeners too. But like Almaty in Kazakhstan, I mean, what sense did you get from the country and whether it's any happier now than it was when it was part of the USSR?
Well, that was what was so interesting. So, yeah, I knew that the collapse of the Soviet Union was something that really came about internally. I knew that people wanted that to happen. And I think from an American perspective, yeah, these names in these countries were not necessarily familiar to me before my trip, but I definitely thought of the collapse of the Soviet Union as really a moment of freedom for the people living in that part of the world. And while I was traveling through, especially the Central Asian republics, I was so surprised to learn that a lot of people were actually nostalgic for Soviet days. So the Soviet Union, of course, was not very nice to many almost all minority groups. But one thing it did do is it went into very remote and in sometimes rugged places like the mountains of Tajikistan, and they built infrastructure and schools. And so since the Union collapsed, there really has been a decline in standard of living in some places. So I think that explains why sometimes people spoke about Soviet days in really much rosier terms than I was expecting.
Oh, the things we had that we don't get anymore, that sort of thing, sure.
Right, electricity, roads, really basic needs.
And Kazakhstan's place, a much more prominent place in the Soviet space program because all the launches and landings were there.
Right. So Kazakhstan, I write about in the book, actually inherited essentially the equivalent of the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And so it sort of became its own nation with its own space program, which is not something that I think happened in any of the other republics and not really something you're expecting a brand new nation to sort of, I don't know, start up or already have running is a space program. And so the first thing Kazakhstan did when it became an independent nation one of the first things, it sent an astronaut into space, which I just think says a lot about sort of the Soviet mentality.
Go Kazakhstan, go. Yeah. No, but from space flight to your bus trip from Kazakhstan to Kyrgyzstan, the details are quite rich. Did you have any preconceived notions of what you'd see on that trip?
You know, in Central Asia, I think a little bit less so. I didn't know very much about it. But what I did know, I think, was, again, the Soviet history. And so I think I was expecting to find people who are really happy to be independent from that. And like I said before, that wasn't so much what I found. But I think I also expected to be treated a little bit differently as an American and maybe met with more hostility. You know, of course, the U.S. and the USSR didn't have terribly great relationships, and a lot of those haven't improved since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I was surprised that people were so kind and welcoming, and I never once felt when I revealed that I was American that people suddenly were more suspicious of me or didn't like me. And so that was a pleasant surprise.
We're talking to Audrey Murray about her journeys through the former Soviet republics in her book, Open Mic Night in Moscow. I'm amazed by page 25 how well you managed to navigate these remote parts of the world with not a whole lot of language skills besides English. Did you worry about getting stuck or stuck in situations you couldn't get out of?
I think I worried about that for probably the first day, and then I stopped because I was constantly stuck in situations. And I think what's so interesting is when we think about going to a place that we're not really prepared to go to, maybe because we don't speak the language or we don't know a lot about it, it's so easy to worry, oh my God, how will I ask for a glass of water? How will I find out what type of meat is being served? And when you're in that situation and all you have to rely on is sort of the language skills that you have and then whatever body language you can conjure up, I quickly got very good at pantomiming everything. If I didn't know what type of meat was being served, I really developed this quick routine where I would sort of impersonate the different animals that I thought it could be until someone was like, yes, yes, that's it. When you're in the situation, I think you're sort of forced to adapt and you quickly just stop worrying about it.
I was wondering if you did barnyard animals. Did you eat a lot of yak then?
You know, I don't think I ate yak at all throughout my trip. I'm actually not sure what the yaks are used for. So I stayed with a family of yak herders in Tajikistan. And I stayed with a lot of nomadic people in every place I went, Mongolia, Kyrgyzstan, or wherever those people lived. And, of course, people who kept sheep in Mongolia, tended to use that for wool. There were certainly a lot of people who raised livestock that would later be used for meat, like goats. But yeah, I'm not sure about the yaks. I'll have to go back and get that answer.
There's a funny, well, there's a lot of funny lines in the book, actually, but one in particular where you say, guidebooks have a way of tricking me into thinking I enjoy nature.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not really an outdoorsy person. I'm sure your listeners have a lot more access to sort of like beautiful scenic places than I have living in cities most of my life. But I find that I imagine being in nature will be this very like quiet, peaceful experience. And in Kyrgyzstan, I went on a horse trek for 2 days. And I very quickly discovered that while it was a very quiet experience and could be peaceful, there was a lot of wildlife that I was not really emotionally prepared to deal with. And so I spent one night in a yurt where there was a group of moths that sort of dive-bombed me throughout the night. And I was just so terrified that somehow I was like thinking in my head, like, okay, can a moth kill me? Can they eat me? What are they trying to do? So when I get into those situations, I'm definitely not as zen as I think I'll be when I'm reading in a guidebook, oh, it's a beautiful mountainscape, and there are all these trees and rivers. So, yeah.
P.S. Watch out for moths.
Yeah, exactly. They should include that.
So while your body is in Kyrgyzstan on a horse, your mind is in Shanghai with Anton. Tell us about Anton and why your mind was still on him.
Yeah, so Anton was one of the emotionally unavailable Russian men I mentioned in my title. He was someone that I met doing comedy in China, and he was from Belarus. But besides that, I think we just had a lot in common, and we really clicked, and it was one of those sort of mid-20s relationship that was really intense and then just didn't work out because of timing. And so I think that also played a big part in making me want to see and understand the former Soviet Union, especially Belarus, because I thought maybe that would hold some key to understanding why I was so hung up on this person and how I could sort of move past it.
Okay, so you had to do some exploration to sort of figure out what had happened to you in the relationship.
Yeah, and I guess I felt like I had to really understand these places because I sort of found myself, I kept being drawn to Russian men. And so I thought, well, if it's not working out, is it maybe because there's too much of a cultural difference and I need to do some work here to figure out, why Russians, for example, I don't know, this is silly, but they don't wear their shoes inside the house, you know, smaller things. And of course, I found it wasn't really that. But I was lucky that the culture and the places that I went to were so rich and interesting and fascinating. And I think that was really what helped me move past that relationship.
All the journeys are told in the book Open Mic Night in Moscow, a book by Audrey Murray, and other stories from my search for black markets, Soviet architecture, and emotionally unavailable Russian men. You might tell that Audrey is a stand-up comedian, so she's been busy over the years in entertaining people from stages, but entertains them in a book now. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Have questions for Audrey about what's been going on in her journeys overseas or some observations to share. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Question here from Becca in Lane County, who says that area is so mysterious because we hear so little about those countries in the media, and she wonders if you are monitored a lot.
You know, that's a really good question. I definitely didn't feel very monitored, but I understand what Becca means. I think when you go to these places, there are really a lot of these countries are run by very authoritarian regimes. And I would imagine that people living in those countries are heavily monitored. I think being a tourist, especially someone who isn't really engaged in any subversive or political activities while you're there, you don't really feel that as much. And I think one of the things that's really almost reassuring is I crossed a lot of land borders to get into these countries. So you're sort of filling out all the paperwork and you're seeing what the border guards have sort of as their records or maybe what they have on you. And so little of that is digital. And it makes you realize, wow, you know, they're trying to, I think, make it seem like you're being watched all the time. But I'm not sure how quickly they're able to coordinate with different offices. So it was an interesting experience. I had to keep pieces of paper to account for each night that I'd spent in Uzbekistan. And you have to show those when you're leaving the country to prove where you slept each night. And so that feels very like Big Brother-y. Mm-hmm. But again, they're just pieces of paper. There's no official seal or anything like that. And so you kind of do wonder, well, how much are they really keeping tabs on me?
Okay, so that's the official position. You mentioned how warm and friendly the people were, but I haven't gotten into this part of it yet, which is, you know, a part of the world where there's a lot of dark hair, and you are a redhead, as you point out in the first line of your biography on the book flap, and I just wonder if you got stared at a lot.
No, so what is so interesting about the Soviet Union is that it was sort of a melting pot for the territory that it covered. So that's a lot of course, European people and Asian as well. And so one thing that a lot of people who've traveled through that part of the world have remarked on is how easy it is to blend in if you're from or if your ancestors are from Europe or Asia. So having red hair wasn't really unusual anywhere that I went because a lot of native and ethnic Russians have red hair. So I was really surprised, even in places like Tajikistan, because there had been that history of Russian occupation and there were still ethnic Russians living there, people couldn't always tell that I was a foreigner until I opened my mouth and started speaking.
So, Audrey Murray, the one thing I haven't asked is how you could afford all of this.
So that was actually probably the biggest thing that I never thought I would be able to figure out. I think I'd had this trip in my mind for a really long time, but I was like, yeah, there's no way I'll ever be able to pay for this. I was really lucky because while I was living in Shanghai, stand-up comedy, as you mentioned, does not pay well, so I had to find a day job. And the day job that I found was SAT tutoring Chinese students who wanted to go to college or university in America. And so it was a great day job. It was very flexible in terms of hours, and I also really enjoyed working with the students that I worked with. I sort of fell into a position where an old boss said, hey, would you be willing to come back to Shanghai for sort of the brief busy periods that pop up every few months. You could work for a few weeks, and then you could go back to New York. And I thought, well, I could do that, or I could, in the interim, travel through the Soviet Union. So, yeah, it was really, it was so lucky.
So did you have fun changing currencies between all these former Soviet republics? Oh, that must have been interesting.
You know, I am not very good at math to begin with. And another problem that I had was that a lot of the currencies have the same name. So, for example, in Kyrgyzstan, the currency is called the sum. And in Tajikistan, it's called the sum as well. And so I write about in the book while I was crossing, when I first entered Kyrgyzstan, I was trying to negotiate a ride into the nearest city. And so you're often bargaining in that part of the world. And so I was bargaining with this driver. And I started to notice that everyone kind of around us was giving me really weird looks. And finally he said, you know, you're haggling with me over 50 U.S. cents. And that's when I looked down at the currency converter that I'd been using, and I realized I'd been doing it all in the wrong currency. So I thought he was trying to charge me like $40 for a trip that was actually in total something like $4, and I was still driving a really hard bargain. So it was so embarrassing, and I, of course, quickly was like, oh my God, yes, the number you said is fine.
Do the countries, Audrey, blur together in your memory, or do you have distinct memories from each of them?
Yeah, I think, actually, I was surprised by how distinct each country felt. in Central Asia, of course, each country has its own language. And what's really interesting to travelers is each country has its own distinctive headwear. So there are different hats that men wear in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Turkmenistan that makes them very, it makes the visual distinction pretty easy. But even the culture could be, well, there were, of course, a lot of similarities. There were differences that you felt in each country as well. So, for example, Uzbekistan was a country that had a really rich tradition of literature and poetry.
You can keep going. We got almost of a minute left.
Oh, great. Okay. So, and some of the other Central Asian countries had been more traditional nomadic herders, and so their art was more decorative arts that you would use in a yurt. So it sounds weird, but you can tell the difference between a country that spent a lot of time, I guess, reading and writing, and a country that spent a lot of time, you know, herding animals and trying to make a living in really what can be very rugged territory at times.
Kudos to you for recognizing the differences. We have more to talk about with Audrey Murray. Her book is Open Mic Night in Moscow, and other stories from my search for black markets, Soviet architecture, and emotionally unavailable Russian men. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Audrey Murray and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Audrey Murray, who describes herself as a redhead from Boston, moved to Shanghai to work, and took up stand-up comedy while she was there, and then figured she'd take her comedy skills on the road, and boy, what a road it was, across most of Asia and a good chunk of Europe as well. She explored the former Soviet Union and her fascination with it. The book she's written about her odyssey is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. It's a conversation you can join with questions or comments or observations about that part of the world. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We mentioned the opening for the drum circle in Kazakhstan. Did you do other comedy nights along the way?
Yeah, so I sort of did them. My biggest shows were the bookends of my trip. The show in Kazakhstan was at the very beginning. And then when I got to Moscow, there's actually a pretty big English language comedy scene there. And so I was able to do a couple of the shows in English and also meet some of the Russian stand-ups who perform in Russian. And they're huge right now. They have their own TV show, and stand-up is really still a new art form there, and people are really grabbing onto it. They're getting, they can fill huge auditoriums full of fans, and they get a ton of people tuning in every week. And it's always interesting to go to another country and see what people find funny there.
Well, and then Lauren in Lane County had to get out of the car, and so she didn't stay on the line. She said, what kind of jokes do you tell to non-English speakers?
You know, what's so interesting is that I think wherever you go, you kind of find there are some recurring themes that everyone will find funny. So, for example, if you talk about dating, that's a really universal experience. I think you can probably go to any country in the world and find young people who, or people of any age really, who find dating difficult. If you talk about family, sort of family dynamics, family pressure, that's pretty universal as well. But in Russia, I also had jokes about my obsession with Russian language and culture and about my Russian ex-boyfriends. And so that worked really well there as well.
Did you get edgy or topical and talk about you don't want to get too far away from a security camera in Moscow if you're a journalist or, you know?
No, I didn't. I think mostly because topics like that, of course, I probably would have gotten in trouble if I'd done that. But also I think it's probably not, it's a hard topic to make jokes about because I think a lot of people's reaction to that is going to be, it sort of makes people think about things that are really troubling and are really upsetting. And I think it can be really hard to turn that on its head. So I talk about self-censorship, and I think some of that is people are afraid to say things about the government, especially on television. But I think also you forget sometimes that those aren't always the most meaty or the topics most conducive to jokes.
Yeah, that can be true. Why did people keep telling you that the best taste of the old Soviet Union was in Belarus?
So Belarus is a really interesting country. Belarus is, I think, the only country that when they still build, you know, they could build a brand new monument today and they would still write SSSR, which means USSR in Russian, on the building. So Belarus is an independent nation, but I think it was one of the countries that sort of was most reluctant to forge a new post-Soviet identity. So when you walk around, all of the buildings still feel very Soviet. The economy is still very Soviet. And I write about in the book, I spent a lot of time with these young kids in Minsk who were sort of trying to figure out what to do with their lives because jobs were kind of more or less what they were in Soviet days. You could go work in a factory, maybe, or you could get some job as a cog in a big machine. And a lot of these people were sort of more artistic or hipster types, and they were really trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with my life here?
You know, Belarus is called Europe's last dictatorship, and but there are other countries where things are fairly oppressive too. And Turkmenistan sounds fairly oppressive. How oppressive is it Ashgabat? Is that the capital?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that was actually the one place where I did feel extremely uncomfortable. So Turkmenistan is definitely, I would say, the closest to, a lot of people would say, North Korea, or it's really the least liberal of the former republics. And so when you're walking around the streets in Ashgabat, the president has his picture on the sides of buildings, and the president before him built gold statues of both himself and this basically autobiography that he self-published and forced everyone to read. He made statues of that as well that he put all over the city. And it's just really unsettling, I think, to see that sort of cult of personality just treated so casually and so part of daily life.
Well, and one of the things, though, is that while you got the pictures of the president up on the sides of the buildings, you're not allowed to take pictures. Is that right?
Yeah, you're not allowed to take pictures in any of the cities, which is so strange. There were all of these strange rules, especially the former president made every newscaster start off the news by saying something like, "I swear to tell the truth, and if I don't, my tongue will be cut out," or something like that. So there are all kinds of, like, strange quirks. There's a curfew in the capital city. And it makes you feel, when you're there, like, oh, I feel like I could really do something terrible without realizing what the rules are.
And although you rebel, you took pictures, I hear.
Yeah, so I sort of figured out this, I'm so bad at following rules in general, but especially when I feel like they're so unfair. And so I figured out this way to hold my cell phone to my ear, and I tried to hold it perpendicular to the ground. And then when you do that, you can turn on your camera and then press the volume buttons on the side, and that'll snap a picture. But to a person walking by, it looks like you're just taking a phone call, although you're holding the phone at a very strange angle. And yeah, that was my way of being like, well, I'm going to do this anyway.
But this is the point where there's absolutely no comedy, at least for a few minutes of reading the book, where you thought you were taking a cab to the hotel in Ashgabat, but what happened instead?
Yeah, so in Central Asia, you get around by these shared taxis, which is basically just a regular person driving his car, usually with other passengers, and if they're headed in your direction, they'll take you there. So I got into what I thought was one of those, and they drove past the hotel, and then they ended up driving really far out of the city center and out into the desert. And Turkmenistan is 80% desert. Ashgabat is the capital city, but outside of that, it's really completely deserted and isolated. And so when I realized what was going on, I knew I had to get out of that car immediately. And so I ended up sort of quick thinking, I guess, although it feels more like it was like survival instinct kicking in. I opened the door on the highway in front of this big on-ramp, and that created enough of a diversion. People were honking and really drawing a lot of attention to us that the men pulled over, and I jumped out of the car and ran. So it was definitely, it was a really scary moment, and it was probably the first time I realized, okay, I do need to be careful. I felt safe for the rest of my trip, but, you know, I hate to say that because I wouldn't want to dissuade other women from traveling. But it was a moment, I guess, where you realize, oh, I really am vulnerable and I'm really far away from anyone who could help me if things do go wrong.
Well, that is a scary moment. In fact, you had a moment yourself on the beach on the Caspian Sea after that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, like I was saying before about not speaking the language, when you're in a country and you're in a really, you know, what feels like a life or death situation, I think it's really easy to just not think about what you're doing and get yourself out of there. So I knew I had to leave the country immediately. I went and I bought a ticket and I flew to the exit port that I had to exit the country from. And it wasn't until I think I got away from the city and I had a little bit of time from the incident where those men tried to drive me out into the desert. And I was on the Caspian Sea, and it sort of, the reality of what hit me happened. And I got really emotional. It was really strange. I found myself just feeling an immense sense of gratitude. And I write about in the book, it really felt like the moment in my life where I was probably the best version of myself that I'll ever be. It was like I was incapable of feeling any negative feeling just because I was so grateful that I had gotten out of that situation okay and unscathed.
There's another moment that you relate, and it's a bit later in the trip when you arrived in Russia itself, in St. Petersburg. Tell us about the moment there.
Yeah, so throughout this whole trip, you know, I had been thinking, oh my God, can I do this? There were a lot of moments where I was in Uzbekistan trying to get a visa to the next country, and I was like, this, what I'm trying to do is just so hard. I'll never be able to pull this off. And I always knew that the first leg of my trip would end in Russia, but I spent so much time sort of trying to figure out the details up until that point that I, again, never really stopped to process sort of the enormity of what I was doing. And I got to St. Petersburg, and I just felt, wow, okay, I wanted to travel across the former Soviet Union. I set out on that journey. I wasn't sure I'd make it, and here I am. And it was also a really emotional moment, and I was so proud of what I'd been able to do, despite what a lot of people would say was not the most robust trip planning beforehand.
Ad hoc trip planning, make it up as you go.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I do love your writing here about getting a sense of Paris at first in St. Petersburg, but that dissipates. What happens as you travel further through St. Petersburg?
Well, so St. Petersburg, if your listeners haven't been, is a really beautiful city. It was built by Peter the Great to be the capital of his new, more European Russia. And the architecture really reflects that. You've got these gorgeous buildings and avenues, and you've got huge monuments, the Winter Palace, all of these really visually impressive things. But definitely the further you go into Russia and the further you go on the outskirts of St. Petersburg as well, that sort of peters out, and what you have is more sort of like, I like to think of sometimes the architecture of the Soviet Union as the country aspiring to be the best version of itself, you know, this country that really provided for everyone and where everyone was equal. But you get to the outskirts, and there are more of those concrete, prefabricated apartment buildings that a lot of us probably picture when we think of the Soviet Union. And you sort of see how, no matter how what the aspirations were, the reality maybe was not what people had originally intended.
So, Audrey, you've talked several times now about the hospitality you felt in Central Asia when you were in the likes of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. How does that compare with the kind of welcome you got from the Russians themselves?
You know, it was really similar, which also surprised me. I think we often think of Russians as fairly serious, sort of, I guess we picture Russian people as not really smiling that much. And I think that's true. I think smiling is just not a cultural thing there. But what really surprised me is once you sort of get to know people, people will be so welcoming and generous. I mean, there were so many times in Russia, in Central Asia, in Eastern Europe, where people invited me into their homes, where they saw me walking down the street, and they saw that I was lost, and they were like, can I help you get somewhere? And they helped direct me. And so, you know, of course, you can look at someone and see a certain expression and assume certain things, but I really found people to be, I think people really looked out for the people around them in a way that Americans maybe don't as much.
You mentioned that you didn't really include highly topical stuff in your comedy, but I wonder if you had conversations with Russians about government or Putin or American elections or stuff like that?
Yeah, so that really surprised me. This was before the U.S. This was before the 2016 election, but I was surprised how much regular people brought up the sanctions that had been put on Russia. I think they had really felt those and their inability to purchase certain products. Although, again, on the whole, I think people didn't really seem to hold the fact that I was American or my government's actions against me, and were really happy to get to know me as an individual.
A lot of warmth from a lot of people on the far side of the world, as reflected in Audrey Murray's book, Open Mic Night in Moscow, and other stories from my search for black market Soviet architecture and emotionally unavailable Russian man. Audrey, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.